Welcome to the Kindlings Muse Podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
The sweet sound of sincerity just oozing out of the room. Well, this is Dick Staub, and I want to welcome you to a special edition of the Kindlings Muse tonight at Kindlings Fest on Orcas Island, where we have an unruly live audience. They have been booing and hissing. And joining me tonight is Mr. Purple himself, the irrepressible Nigel Goodwin. Big round of applause for Nigel. And that's going to conclude the show. Thank you very much for being with us. Nigel, this... Again, a professional would know how to turn the music completely off. Listening by podcast, the truth is out, I'm not a professional. A year ago, we talked about the theme that we wanted to explore this year, and we chose the theme Morning into Dancing. What resonated about that theme with you? Why did you feel like we ought to explore that theme this year?
Because I think perhaps it's almost the most important theme to explore. It's about death and life. It's about dying and rising. It's about the deepest questions in people's lives. And although the language of dance is complex for some people and in very elitist for others, I think it's... A great subject for this audience.
So this morning, for people listening on the podcast, they weren't here, and we experienced poetry from you, a dance from Tobin, a music from Susan Osborne, an improv dance from Karin Stevens with Susan Osborne, set to a Rachmaninoff Vesper on Corinthians, though I speak with tongues of angels and have not love, I am nothing, and a lecture from Jerry Root, and comedy from Eric Metaxas.
Well, he's from New York.
Eric is just back there glaring at me. Will the court recorder please take note of that? Why do the arts get at this theme so well? I mean, I personally just have to say I found myself emotionally touched by all of the stuff that was happening this morning in ways that kind of actually caught me off guard a little bit. What goes on with the arts when they get at a subject like Morning into Dancing?
Because I think they are covert rather than overt. They are they touch the human spirit. They touch humanity. Humanity crying out for meaning, for purpose, but often fed up with words. Often other languages, I think, are speaking, particularly to young people today, and particularly the language of movement, of dance. I think it's a very powerful language, and people identify with it. I mean, some ways to lose themselves and to escape, but equally to find themselves. So it can go both ways. You can get lost, if you like, in art. You can let art seduce you and take you down all kinds of roads, but you can also allow art to help you to discover more of who you are and more of who you're intended to be and become.
So now I've heard you talk about right brain, left brain. I've heard you talk about the mind, the heart, and the viscera, and the gut. And
you say it well.
Yes, thank you. What in the heck are you talking about? I mean, where is art connecting with me?
Well, because most of us are brought up with the Greek rationale. Education is all based on head stuff. Much of it is head stuff.
Yeah.
And I think today's generation have moved from that much more existentially to the heart, to what they feel. What do you feel about this? What do you feel about that? Sadly, in that movement, they have lost out, in some cases, on thinking. Head and heart are intended to be connected in the human person, but it is in the gut, in the viscera, as you put it, or the viscera.
No, as you put it. I don't even know what the viscera is. I'm quoting you, and I don't want you to tell me. TMI.
Well, of course, this isn't a visual podcast. All we'll all see clearly with Dick what the viscera is.
Now I got to look it up.
But the gut is the birthing place. It is actually the voice of the prophet, the voice of the poet, the voice of the dancer. It is the Latin voice. It is the passion voice, and it is the voice where, okay, we hope most people, if they are thinking of having a child, think about it. We hope they feel something very passionately about it. But it actually takes place in the viscera, in the gut. We are born here. And I would love to see the Greek mind and the Hebrew belly brought together. And I think the arts supremely express that. Dance, especially.
Excellent. All right. These are people that know what a viscera is, obviously. Well, I'm going to ask Michael Card to come up now and join us at this lovely table. And Michael and I have something that we share in common, and that is a common mentor, a guy named Bill Lane, who I studied with at Gordon-Conwell Seminary. Bill was a Harvard Divinity School grad. And I was in a class at Gordon-Conwell, and a guy stood up and was complaining about the... No. But you will need a microphone. Another professional forgetting that he's got to use a microphone. There was a guy complaining about the lyrics of contemporary Christian music, and Bill Lane says we need to stop complaining and ask God to raise up biblically literate lyricists. 10 years later, I am in Washington, D.C. at some event, and I see this guy walk up to a piano and talk about El Shaddai, and talk about the different words for God in Hebrew. And I thought, this is the answer to Bill Lane's prayer. And find out later, well, tell him you're part of the Bill Lane story, how you got connected in the beginning.
Bill put me together the way Frankenstein put the monster together. You know.
Excellent. Can you explain? Now we're back to a viscera kind of story. Well, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I resonated with that. No, Bill was he was my principal professor for 6 years, and he gave leadership to the little church, little biracial church. PhD from Harvard, speaking to 25 elderly African-American members and a bunch of college students. And then I went on for 21 more years with him, corresponding and very close. And then when he found out he had cancer, he called me from Seattle Pacific University and said, I don't want to die here. Can I come to Franklin and show you how a Christian man dies? So he moved in with me for 18 months, and I was holding his hand when he died. So as much as one person can owe, I would never have written music if it wasn't for Bill. He was the first person to ask me to write a song. I would love to say that I'm a deeply spiritual person. I heard God's voice, but it was Bill's voice I heard, and I was just trying to please Bill. I would love to say that I was trying to please the Lord, but all I've got is mixed motives, so there it is. Sorry, TMI.
Yeah. But you don't have to wear that "What Would Bill Do" bracelet anymore.
Yeah, I know.
It's a little overboard. So tell me about him asking you to write a song.
Well, I was in college and grew up in Nashville. Grew up playing, right? Everybody played in Nashville, and with this little church, no one was musical. And he said, "You play guitar, don't you?" And I said, "Well, yeah." But guitars were just for catching girls, for attracting women in college, with no other purpose.
You're not spiritual, are you?
No, I'm not. No. And again, he gives me a sermon and says, you know, it's John 21, second miraculous catch of fish. Could you write a little chorus for us? And that's where I started.
Seriously?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
You really, well, it's impossible to know whether you would have written or not. But you didn't have
I
didn't have any personal inclination to sit down and write?
No.
And how many songs have you written now?
Somebody counted them and told me the other day, 383 is the current count. I don't know that many. I know about 40 of them. So.
That's what is this, a Milli Vanilli kind of thing?
How many of your sermons do you remember, right?
Well, you know, when I was in seminary, they also told me that preaching is throwaway communication.
I don't like that.
They said you preach it and you got to let it go and move on to the next. You don't like that?
No.
Why not?
No, that's a dumb idea. If it's worth preaching, it's worth holding on to, because what you're asking your listeners to do is right, is to resonate and accept that. So, I don't like that idea at all. I don't
Yes, ladies and gentlemen.
I don't like disposable music. I mean, I think that's what's one
Wait a minute. What do you mean disposable music?
That's what's wrong with – don't get me started.
No. Come on, man. Come on. Don't hold back, Michael, baby. got him now. He's
on the
ropes.
That's what's wrong with so much of Christian music now. You know, whatever the hit is for 2 or 3 months and everyone sings it till they're sick of it and then you never hear it again. And earlier in Christian music, we never threw music away. And we got hymnals under the chairs. You know, that's a mechanism for holding on to music that's worth holding on to. We don't do that anymore. So I'm anti-screen. Thank you.
Good.
I'm anti-screen. I'm anti-too. It's too loud. I'm becoming my father. So there it is.
Well, you're going to play for us in just a second. But before you do, Michael is leading our devotions this morning, tomorrow morning and the rest of the week. And it was interesting because I've known Michael for a long time, and like many of you, knew him first as a musician. But the more I got to know him, the more I got to know him as a thinker and a writer and somebody that was on a really serious pursuit despite what he's saying. And I like what he's saying about not being spiritual because Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner, is a daily prayer. So I totally understand that. Having said that, you've written some amazing stuff, and I wanted you to be here as a devotional leader, not first and foremost as a musician. I love you as a musician, but I feel like this is a major chapter of your life that needs to be experienced by the body. Mm. What can you just give us a little sense of where you see yourself going the next few mornings in terms of this theme of mourning into dancing?
Well, I want to start out. I know what I'm doing tomorrow. That's about as much as I can do. There's a basic understanding about lament. I've done a lot of work, 2 books and a record on lament. That's been a focus for a long, long time. And I'm going to start the basic rationale for understanding lament in terms of a journey. And the journey that the scriptures take us on, the Psalms, Genesis to Revelation, Psalm 1 to Psalm 151 or 150, and from the first chapter of Job to the end, it's a similar journey, and it's a wonderful self-evident truth that the Bible's taking us somewhere, and that's very encouraging to me. And the structure's very self-evident. I think it's pretty cool. So I got tomorrow covered, and we'll see how the other 2 days go.
Good. Yeah. But this thing of lament has been part of your journey, and so it really is a theme you connect with.
Oh, it's huge. Yeah, it's huge.
How did that happen?
Well, I've been the observer of a lot of suffering. The Lord knows our frame. He knows we're dust, and we'll never be, tested beyond what we're able to bear. So I must be pretty fragile because I've never really experienced a lot of suffering. But my sister's lost 2 of her children in 2 separate. She lost 2 babies in 13 months. My mother lost a child before I was born, so I sort of grew up in the shadow of this little boy who died before me. And then my brother lost an 18-year-old son to cancer. This all happened fairly, in 3 or 4 years. And my mother died. My best friend died on the same day. And I'm just always processing. I mean, that's what we do. That's what artists do, right? We process. We think out loud. And in the middle of this very industrial worship thing that's happening in American Christianity, which I've never felt very much a part of, I've always felt like a second-class spiritual citizen because I can never sort of immediately go where everybody seems to be able to go. And so I'm processing lament, and I've discovered that numerically most of the Psalms are laments, that Job, David, Jeremiah, Jesus, Habakkuk, they all hold on, by lament.
And they all speak, Michael, from the Hebrew voice, from that journey of lostness, Jerusalem, out into Babylon. It's this yearning, this longing. And there is this in young people today, next generation, there's a yearning, there's a memory in everyone. And that's lamentation.
Mm.
But there's also a longing, isn't there? A longing. Can't it be different? It ought to be different. Couldn't it be different?
Well, I think, Nigel, we've missed the whole fundamental, the basis for worship is, I think this, in Psalm 51, David says, it's not the blood of bulls and goats you want, it's the sacrifice of God, a broken spirit and a contrite heart, right? And this is right after Bathsheba, after he's destroyed his life. And if you look in the prophets, especially you talk about the Hebrew part, Jeremiah makes this realization, Ezekiel makes this realization, they at some point they go, it's not the sacrifices you want. Gee, it's us. It's our hearts, and it's their brokenness. And so you look at Jesus, and, you know, at the point in Jesus' life when he's most being used by God, what's he doing? He's lamenting. And so then I realized that the thing that hurts me the most can be the most precious thing I have to offer God. And that's where all the lights came on for me. That broken spirit, contrite heart. And I thought, well, if that's what God wants, well, I'm the best worshiper he's got. You know, if he wants my confusion and my anger and if he receives that as an offering, well, I'm in. You know, I'm the worship person of all time, because that's all I've got. You know, mixed motives and brokenness and foolishness. And
well, we're really looking forward to this week, and I'd love it if you'd go over to the keyboard and sing something for us.
I'll do the theme song, all this. How's that?
Okay. Let's give a big round of applause to Michael Clark.
Okay, is this on? I want to thank everybody for making me feel so welcome. I know no one else here talks like me. This felt real good. This call, Come Lift Up Your Sorrows. I wrote this with Vance Taylor, who is, in my mind, one of the greatest living musicians, a little guy in Atlanta, Georgia. Great piano player.
If you are wounded, and if you're alone, if you are angry, if your heart is cold as stone, if you have fallen, and if you are weak, then come find the worth of God that only the suffering seek. Come lift up your sorrows and offer your pain. Come make a sacrifice of all your shame there in your wilderness. He's waiting for you to worship him with your wounds. For he's wounded too. He has not stuttered, and he has not lied. When he said, come unto me, you're not disqualified. If you're heavy laden, you may want to depart. But those who know sorrow, they're closest to his heart. Sing, come lift up your sorrows
and offer your pain.
And offer your pain.
Come make a sacrifice.
And come make a sacrifice
of all your shame.
Of all your shame. And there in your wilderness,
he's waiting for you.
He's waiting for you. to worship Him with your wounds, to worship Him with your wounds, for He's wounded in this most holy place. He's made a sacred space for those who will enter in and trust to cry out to Him. And you'll find no curtain there, no reason left for fear. And there's perfect freedom here to weep every unwept tear. Come on. So lift up your sorrows and offer your pain.
Come make a sacrifice.
And come make a
I'm going to ask Larry McAdams to come up now. He's our artist in residence. And while he's coming up, there were a couple of things that occurred to me. One is that story about Bill Lane is really kind of haunting me. You'll sit right over here, Larry. Because what you just heard might not have happened if somebody wouldn't have tapped somebody on the shoulder and said, you've got to do something with who you are, with what God has given you. And I often think of that Edmund Burke quote, most men live lives of quiet desperation and die with the song still in them. That's what could have happened. And this is the importance of community and calling each other forth and encouraging each other and stirring each other up to good deeds and to take the gifts that you have. And we all have certain loaves and fishes, and we all feel like we don't have much if we're smart and realistic. But what you've got, God can use. You know, so it's about faithful. It's not just about talent. It's not just about, you know, and it's certainly not about celebrity and all the things that so much of the world is wrapped up in, unfortunately, including the Christian commercial world. But it's about being faithful to our trust and what God has invested in us. And that, Michael, you just, that scares me to think that Bill wouldn't have had that conversation with you. Just, it scares me. That was beautiful. Now, this is going to sound like a commercial moment, but what album is that on? Hidden Face of God. And Holly, we're going to have that downstairs? Okay. You want to all just leave and buy one now? Okay. Well, Larry, good to have, do you want me to call you Larry or Lawrence? Tell me about the Larry Lawrence thing.
The gallery says Larry's too casual and LL could be a girl. So it should be Lawrence. So since I'm into branding, sounded good to me.
Well, Lawrence, I want to apologize, first of all, for calling you Larry all the years I've known you.
I don't want answer to Lawrence, so Larry's just fine.
How did you become an artist? How did you get? Were you drawing from the time you were a little kid?
No, I successfully suppressed my artistic desire till I was 47 years old.
Seriously, but I thought you were an art major in college.
I was a commercial art major, and I have an advertising and web company. But in terms of painting, drawing, fine art, I was taught that it was not utilitarian, wasn't measurable. If you loved it, it must be bad because our hearts are deceitfully wicked, and who can know them?
Wait a minute. It sounds like you got advice from
Christians. What were they telling you?
Yes, as I was telling some people today at lunch, I had great parents, but they only had half the gospel. And it was, this world is not our home. We're just passing through it. I think it's a song.
So we can kick it to bits.
Right. Our hearts are deceitful above all things. Who can know them? Yeah. Our righteousness is filthy rags. And put your nose to the grindstone, and in heaven you'll have 70 virgins. Wait, I'm getting mixed up. That was the basic message, though.
Clearly, a 60s kid did.
Yeah.
Vestal virgins.
I don't mean to. I shouldn't have been derisive of Christians because I am in that tribe. But, a lot of us were raised in these backgrounds. And one of the things about the Kindlings, when we say we're inspired by the Inklings, without getting into great detail, I mean, it's not... It's not a surprise that C.S. Lewis died in 1963, J.R. Tolkien died in 1973, and almost all of evangelicalism grew up after them. And it was the abandonment of an intellectual, spiritual, and creative legacy. I mean, we understand for 2,000 years, Christians created the culture. The idea that a Christian would not have made art would have just been completely foreign until these last 50 years, 100 years. And there's all sorts of historical explanations for that. But this is another dying with the art still in you song.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what liberated you at the age of 46? What happened?
I went to a John Eldridge conference, Wild at Heart, Sacred Romance, Waking the Dead, Journey of Desire. And I walked out 6 hours later going, oh, my God.
Really?
Yeah. Wait a minute. There's another half to Christianity. We're fearfully and wonderfully made. Delight yourself in the Lord. He'll give you the desires of your heart. We have a new heart of flesh, not of stone. And I went home and quit all the boards I was on. I was on the elder board, the school board, the missions board. I mean, I was bored.
Yeah.
And then one morning, about 6 months later, I was telling someone at lunch today, I woke up, this never happened to me before, it's never happened to me since, and I said, I've got to start painting.
Wow.
And I was 47. And the first painting I painted was for my wife. It was a picture of her mother I started in college that I had saved the canvas in the attic.
Wow.
And from then, I've been trying to make it for lost time.
Man, well, you're doing an amazing job. Those of us here can look over in the center panel here. Is Larry's work from beyond that first window there, and then two smaller pieces in the middle, and then the next one. Now, you brought a PowerPoint that is kind of the making of one of these pieces.
Right. I brought two PowerPoints, but in terms of timing, I actually painted this last one on the far right, Aurora, for this event because of the idea of mourning into joy. And I was struck by Psalms of 35, weeping may tarry for the night, but joy comes with the morning. And I was thinking about the fact that many of us, except for Michael, have had a lot of difficulties in our lives. And so I liken that as this person on a high cliff, and it's stormy, and yet it's morning, and she has hope. In fact, she has so much hope, as we heard this morning, that she's taken off her rose-colored glasses and is trying to face the day as it is.
Wow.
And then the shoe represents the journey, and the name is Aurora for dawn, and also because of Michelangelo's sculpture at the de' Medici tomb. So I painted that actually for this event.
Wow. And so the PowerPoint we're going to see is kind of walks us through that?
Right. So the second one. Thank you.
Who did your logo? That's incredible. A lot of your work has got a sensual feel to it. Where does that originate from, and how does that help us connect to your work?
Well, I like the idea of a painting attractive people, and I like the idea of painting things that could just pass for any activity of any day. And like the movie The Matrix or Adjustment Bureau, everything that's real is sort of under the surface. And so you can look at it and say, oh, that's a great painting. I really enjoy your painting. Or you can look at it and go, wait a minute. You know, like, I don't know if you can notice in this painting, in the middle, the bottom painting, there's a guy wearing dark glasses and he's got a book in his hand. But in the clouds, there's a woman speaking to him. And most people don't see that until you look at it several times. But the idea is that he's going about his business and he's missing the story of creation. He's missing the fact that God's talking to us every second of every day.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to get to that without being blatant, or so I'm cloaking it in attractive people and everyday occurrences, yeah. And yet trying to get to that somehow.
The top piece, the dance, almost looks like a dancer leaping out of nowhere to nowhere.
Well, I painted that in Colorado over Lake Dillon, and I thought, how do I capture the joy of creation, you know, the enjoyment and the sort of emotional high that it gives you. And so I thought of this person sort of 7-league jump, you know, and being able to leap across a landscape. That's where that came from.
That is awesome. And what about the final one?
Well, that's my idea. So someone asked me, they said, how come you don't paint any Christian paintings? I said, every one of my paintings is a Christian painting. It's just that you can't tell. For example, that one's called Whirlwind, and my idea was, that's Eve at the moment after she ate the apple. And notice how the leaves have become so sharp that one's cutting her just about. Yet she's still holding on. She still has hope. There's still going to be a redeemer at some point in time.
Gallery director Jeremy Tessner said this about Larry's work, and I love it. Lawrence's work. That's going to be hard. I'm sorry, Lawrence. I had the same problem with Karen Stevens when she went from Karen to Karen at some point. Another secret out of the bag. And my name is actually Walter. But
I thought it was, you know,
the repositioning hasn't helped me. He said, Larry's work suggests film noir. The paintings hint that mystery and beauty of life is most evident in those moments when things seem to make the least sense. That really touched me, and that really connected to me, and I can tell you're moved by it right now. How does that capture who you are and want to be as an artist?
Well, how many of you have figured out everything? I figured out next to nothing. And so I'm just trying to get at it every time, like a map of C.S. Lewis said, what's more real, New York or a map of New York? Well, New York's more real, but you need a map. And so I'm trying to get at some of those truths with my paintings, and yet I'm sure as I paint it, the truth still pushes itself further away.
Oh, man. Well, Larry, Lawrence.
Larry.
I'm going to be out of a job really soon. But thank you so much for being with us, and we'll look forward to seeing you tomorrow at the Art Walk.
Absolutely. Thank
Lawrence
you very
McAdams.
Much.
Thank you. We'll be back with more of the Kindling's Muse right after this. Don't go away. Well, this is Dick Saw back with you live from Kindling's Fest 2011, the Kindling's Muse, and with some great friends. Nigel Goodman is with me up here, Eric Metaxas, the author of a best-selling book on Bonhoeffer, and Jeff Kuse, who also has a great book out right now called Your Neighbor's Hymnal, and they're both with us for Kindling's Fest 2011. Jeff is going to be doing the discussions about the Sundance films that we brought. And Eric is going to be speaking on Friday and Saturday. If you're listening to this podcast, all of these things can be listened to at thekindlings.com. It's so cool to have all you guys here. Eric and I have seen each other a million times in New York, and a bunch of times in a two-week period in England. But it's fun to have you here. Eric, tell us about Dietrich Bonhoeffer and how he and Wilberforce both have something to say about turning mourning into dancing.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
What color is Nigel's jacket?
Well, I actually call it lime electric green.
I'm just glad we're on radio, because that's only my friend Nigel can pull that off.
Yes, and how about your shoelaces, Eric? But we won't even go there.
I know. I want to say
he has yellow shoelaces on.
I just feel very Greek and rational right now. I'm going to be dancing my next book. Did I tell you that? That's not true. Let me tell you, Wilberforce and Bonhoeffer I probably will never write another biography. I very sincerely felt that the Lord called me to write these two books about these two men, and I probably won't write other biographies, but there's something about each of them which spoke to me, because I think they're the sort of people whom we, if we know them, want to emulate. There's something about them. In the case of Wilberforce, of course, well, what they have in common is that each of them was deeply motivated by his Christian faith. This was not phony religiosity. They were changed at some point utterly. And in the case of Wilberforce, of course, he gave his whole life to mainly the abolition of the slave trade. Here's a man who had money, he had power, he had everything, and he gave it all because he knew that God was calling him to do something for these African slaves. It's an extraordinary thing, because he did not live in a culture where it was the thing to do something for others. I mean, if you had money, you felt, well, I'm blessed because God blessed me, and I'm not supposed to use my blessing to be a blessing to those who aren't blessed. It was not part of the culture. But he really, when he became a Christian, everything changed, and he gave his whole life over to that. And of course, in my book, if anyone's read it, you see that he wasn't just the man who led the abolition of the slave trade, but he did everything else. The culture was so broken, they didn't just have slavery, but they had every social ill imaginable. It was a deeply broken culture. And Wilberforce gave himself to every cause you can think of, from child labor to on and on and on and on. And then the good news, of course, is that he succeeded tremendously. God used him to bring about a renaissance, a reformation in all of the British Empire and consequently the world. Bonhoeffer, of course, totally different story, yet extremely similar. Bonhoeffer knew that he had been blessed by God to speak out for those who could not speak. He felt that that's the role of Christians, to be, he called Jesus the man for others. And so what is it to love others? What is it to show the love of Christ? It's to live your whole life in a way to do with those things that God has given you, to do something with them to bless those who can't help themselves. And of course, principally for Bonhoeffer was to speak up for the Jews of Europe during Nazi Germany. So both of them obviously are linked by their profound Christian faith. And I say profound Christian faith because we all know you can be religious, you can be a churchgoer who's not living his life in that kind of way. These are two figures who really, truly, palpably lived their lives for others. And that's what it's all about. Mm-hmm. And there's something beautiful about that, at least I thought so.
Well, we are looking forward to both of your lectures this week that are going to weave together Bonhoeffer and Wilberforce around these themes of mourning into dancing. What about the theme of mourning into dancing connects with your own personal journey and story?
Nothing. I'm a little shy about that, Dick. I told you not to ask me that publicly. But since you did, I think nobody wants to suffer. You'd be a fool if you wanted to suffer. Nonetheless, we know, as the ancient Greeks said, suffering begets wisdom. We know that somehow it's part of the human condition. It's not something we can avoid. We can't step outside the human condition. It's part and parcel of the human condition to suffer. But I think if you suffer in the right way, wisdom can come out of it. And I think that in my life, there's no question that I have been very much humbled, and I'm not trying to be funny, but I don't just mean by you and your dumb jokes this morning, although that was humbling, Dick. That was very humbling to be humiliated publicly. But I'll never mention it again, never.
Yeah. Glad to do it. See you tomorrow.
But don't I get to speak after that? Because careful. So, but I think that to be humbled, to struggle, you realize that if I give that to God, God will bless me. And I think for me, really before the Bonhoeffer book, without getting into that, but you know, trying to be a writer, trying to be an artist, and trying to be an artist as a Christian can be difficult. And in my case, there's no question it was very difficult. It was very difficult. But, you know, we have the quiet joy of knowing God in the midst of difficulty. And yeah. And so for me, I've dealt with, you know, depression and all kinds of things. And we all have something. We all have a host of things. But to know that the God of Scripture is with me in the midst of that, to know that, not merely to hope it, but to know that kind of hope, changes everything. And then when you have some success or something with the Bonhoeffer book doing as well as it's done, you can appreciate it rather differently. You don't think, oh, this is me. Oh, or I better be careful because I can lose this. Lose what? It's a free gift from God to me. And even my ability to write it, everything, that's all a free gift from God. And so you can have a kind of gratitude that you wouldn't have if you thought it was you. Hmm. So
now, you did tell me I could ask you this. The process of the publishing of the Bonhoeffer
yes.
book was itself a morning into dancing story. And it's an important story because
yeah.
anybody that wants to
oh,
get
yes.
in this business is going to have
yeah.
a time or two when something like this happens. Just real briefly. What?
Yeah.
What,
well, I will not mention Harper One by name.
Yes.
We're going to edit that out in post. No, in all seriousness, I had a, yeah, it was a brutal, extraordinary experience, very, very humbling and difficult and a lot of suffering. Basically, I'd written the Wilberforce book, and it did reasonably well, and people kept asking me, who would I like to write about next? Some people said, about whom will you next write? That's, I'm a Yale English major, I had to throw that in. Somehow I thought, Bonhoeffer, yes, Bonhoeffer's the answer. My mom is German, went through this period. There's a lot of reasons I chose that. Maybe I can share about that tomorrow but or Thursday. But I guess I really leapt into the writing of the book, and I had this idea that in order to get the book done, there was a movie coming out, Valkyrie, sort of about this period. And I thought with the Amazing Grace book, there was a movie that helped sell the book, and I thought, who's going to read a 600-page or any kind of a biography of a German theologian. So maybe with the help of this movie, if I can gear it so that when the book comes out, then the movie comes out, it'll help sell the book. So in order to do that, I asked the publisher, you know, could I, if I get the book done by a certain date, would you be able to get it out by when the movie comes out? And he said, yes, and, you know, you need to get done by this date or whatever. And so I practically sprinted from the restaurant where we were having lunch to my keyboard, and worked probably literally typing 12 hours a day, in some cases 8 and 9 days a week. That's a joke, but it felt like it. Week after week after week after week, just working like an absolute madman. I went through 3 wives. Did I mention that? That's true. This is my fourth. I'm sure she feels that way. But I guess it was. It was an. A level of intensity. I say it was kind of like sprinting 26.2 miles to get it done by the certain deadline, and got it done. But somehow, to make the story shorter, the publisher basically said, no, we can't publish it, you know, when we said we were going to publish it. And to do that, to hear that after you have practically killed yourself, and believe me, it was... It was insanity. I don't ever want to live through a tithe of that again. But, you know, to do something specifically for something and then have it say, well, we can't get out there. It was truly heartbreaking. I mean, there's no question about it. I was absolutely heartbroken because you think, I did all that for what? Now it's not going to come out till, you know, whatever, the fall of 2009 anyway. And they needed me to cut the book. They wanted me to cut the book. So I kind of girded up my loins and tried to, again, and you know, cut it somewhat, and submitted it again. And I thought, well, it's just going to come out 6 months later. And then a few months later, found out that, oops, it's not going to come out 6 months later. The publisher said we're going to have to delay it another 6 months, and that was, you know, just financially for one thing, devastating. But it was so hard on me that, you know, my depression sort of kicked in, and I was really unable practically to process it, and I was just crying out to God. For the sake of time, I won't get too specific, but I really was, I felt that God had given me a promise and a word about this book, that it would be okay. And I was clinging to that because I knew somehow he would make everything right. But when the publisher said they couldn't publish it, you know, till a year later, it was so heartbreaking that I said, I can't let them publish this book, because they also wanted me to cut it very significantly. And I'm not doing this justice, but, you know, sometimes you can cut something and then other times you realize to cut would be cutting muscle and bone. I couldn't cut it. So I was really stuck. We had to move it to another publisher. The initials of that publisher are Thomas Nelson. They did a great job with it. And the book has sold well. I have a letter from, it's crazy. I got a handwritten letter from George W. Bush, who had read the book and praised it and is telling his friends to read it. And it's just the oddest thing to see this extraordinary pain, really, to go through this process where I was really genuinely lost. And apart from knowing that somehow God was in this,
Eric,
with me, I wouldn't have been able to get through it.
To what extent do you think God might have been, because of Bonhoeffer and because of his pain, because of what you were tackling, that you also couldn't be so objective? You had to subjectively go through some stuff yourself in term to fully identify.
That may be part of it. I wouldn't want to say that just to agree. I think that there's no question that when you're writing about somebody like Bonhoeffer, you know, I was not writing about Charlie Sheen, you know, and maybe that was my first mistake, I think. But the fact is that I do think that when you write about Bonhoeffer, somebody like Bonhoeffer, yes, you do take in some of that, because you want to talk about intense. He was an incredibly intense figure. I mean, anyone's read the book, that there's just such intensity to this man that it can be difficult. And also, I think this happens to folks who read the book, and it happened to me in spades writing the book. You fall in love with this man. I mean, I've never felt that, you know, part of me definitely can't wait to die just to hug him. Like, what a beautiful thing that's true. I really, you know, you get to meet somebody. And of course, in the course of meeting him, what are we really talking about here? He was someone who knew Jesus intimately. You can tell that when you spend time reading Bonhoeffer. He really knew Jesus. He knew the difference between Jesus and mere religion going through the motions. And to know Jesus the way he knew Jesus, and to have a relationship with the scriptures, to have that, when you spend time with Bonhoeffer, you are spending time with Jesus. So the man of sorrows is Jesus, and we all get a piece of that if we're blessed, you know. But there's no question, yeah, that this was an intense subject to begin with. So,
well, we are looking forward to the Friday and Saturday, and tomorrow Eric will be signing that book, and there are a bunch of them available over at Darvel's on the art walk. He'll be there at 2:00 with the other authors, and I'm really glad you can be with us, Eric. I love you.
My pleasure. I love you, too.
All right. All right.
Thank you.
Dr. Jeff Kuse is a tenured professor at Seattle Pacific University. And he, in my mind, is one of the best catalytic thinkers around the intersection of faith and popular culture, doing the best work in that field. And a lot of that work is, well, as a matter of fact, I don't know if you've heard, but John Stott died today. And John Stott, I met in the late 70s, and he invited me to come to England, because he was developing a center for culture. And he was working on a book and told me about his idea of dual listening, which was Christians need to learn to listen to culture and listen to their faith and be able to bridge between the two of them. And you're sitting looking at this, he looked frail even in those days in a certain way, very, very, very proper Anglican Brit,
who totally got that issue, and he was taking people in his congregation to films, and they had a book club, and Nigel was influential in getting me to go to theaters, and so he had this huge impact on my life, and I, you know, I've written a number of things about that subject, and so I, when he, I heard today that he died, I felt the sense of loss that we all do. And by the way, I my last interview with him was in 1997, and we're going to post it at the Kindling's website tomorrow, so you can go listen to it. It's a 3-part interview. But I actually was thinking about Jeff, because I was thinking, isn't it amazing that someone like John Stott dies and his work is still going on? It is going on. It got hold of me. It got a hold of Jeff. It'll get hold of somebody else. And when God wants his work to happen, nothing will stop it. And so, Jeff, you've written this book, Your Neighbor's Hymnal. What a provocative title. What does that signify, that title? What's this book about?
Well, I'm a music geek, and by music geek, I mean what some people would call pop music. I have been framed my entire life by top 40 AM radio, you know, just kind of stuff listening to. As the boomboxes got smaller and and you started getting iPods, listening to music has always been a part of my story. And as I grew as a theologian, as I grew as a pastor, I always felt like I was being pressured more and more to leave that world behind, that this was the devil's music, that this was the thing that would distract you. It was unthinking. It was unreflective. It would drive you into sexuality or drugs or both at the same time. And
Eric has three wives. Right. I don't know if you know that.
So there was a season of my life, a season of my life where I really bought into that line of thinking, that so-called secular popular music was really an antithesis to what Christians should be doing or engaging in. And I worked for a time for a Christian ministry that had a couple of radio stations, and I worked as the media relations manager for them. And as a result of that, worked with the National Religious Broadcasters Convention, was at the Dove Awards, was engaging with different music labels in the Christian music scene in the late 80s, early 90s. And I remember walking into this hotel in Nashville, and it was the Dove Awards, and it was the GMAs, the Gospel Music Association Awards, and all the executives there and artists were there. And it was a money pit. I mean, they were selling sex, like everybody else was selling sex. There were these beautiful, young people dressing very scantily, and the lyrics that they were supposedly using to proclaim God, it was like love dove from above. That was the line. That's the best they could do. There was nothing novel. It was cheap. It was plastic. There were people walking around with baskets in the lobby throwing CDs at people. I mean, literally getting hit with plastic CDs and falling to the ground. And I remember over in the corner, there was this little World Vision booth, that was kind of lonely, talking about, it was before evangelicalism figured out social justice. They kind of got on that train. I remember just standing back and looking at all of that, and I was part of this industry, and I thought this is where it was all about. And as part of the GMAs, the Gospel Music Association, they had these singer-songwriter things that were going on. And so I went to this one with a number of other record people, and there were some people tuning up, getting the sound check done, getting make sure the white noise in the room and getting everything ready. And all of a sudden, somebody kicked into playing a song off of Fleetwood Mac's Rumours album, which was the first cassette that I ever got in 1977. Started playing it. People were kind of jamming to it, Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow, and they were getting into it. And they said, cut. Okay, we got the sound check. Let's go on and do the real music. And then started playing this song that was boring. It was bland. And it was like, okay, we're going to sell this to every youth group in the planet, and they're going to sell them to their kids because it's safe, and they're going to buy it up in droves because we're going to tell them to, and they're not even going to think about it because all they're going to look is the label, and they're going to go to the Christian bookstore, and that's the hermetically sealed place where you won't get hurt, so you can go to a Christian bookstore to get the good stuff. And I was horrified. And so I literally, left that industry, worked at a couple of other nonprofits, ended up going to seminary, ended up pastoring a church for a short time that was a church plant in the downtown Seattle that had a rock band and was playing Pearl Jam, was playing grunge music in the 90s, and people were coming in and they were listening, and we were engaging those questions around the music they were doing. One of the stories that I have in the book is a funeral that I did a few years back where
this young woman had committed suicide, and she had been a heroin addict. She'd been involved in crack, and she left two small children. And her husband and their group of friends were bikers. They had, you know, more ink on them than a graphic novel. I mean, just covered with tattoos. And so we're arranging for this funeral for this young woman, trying to make sense of this tragedy. And husband, who spoke very little English, pushed the stack of CDs to me. And he says, you know, this is how life made sense to her. And he held up a Metallica CD to me and says, you know, can we play Nothing Else Matters at her funeral? And I looked and I said, that would be awesome. That's perfect. And we sat and he was just shocked. He goes, a pastor would be okay with playing Metallica at a funeral? And I go, well, yeah, if you listen to it and you know the story behind the song and why it was written and what it's doing and how it resolves a minor and major key together and refuses to accept that minor and major are separated from each other, that the chord progression allows there for you to lament and celebration in the same sonic space, abso-freaking-lutely we're going to play this song.
That was an F word. I think I was supposed to beep it.
Two of my wives just walked out.
But I guess all that to say that what the book is about is really my journey, as well as a journey of people I've pastored, people I've buried, people I've celebrated lives with. I mean, these simple, supposedly stupid pop songs are the mixtapes that people play at their weddings. They play for their children. That when tragedy happens and that song comes back on the radio, it comes flooding back like a race car and they can't get it out of their head. So a lot of it's an exploration of what music does to us, how it washes over us.
Yeah.
And the way that God is choosing to use over and over again the simple, plain stuff to awaken a deaf generation.
That's My Neighbor's Hymnal, and it is a fabulous book, and you can pick up a copy. It just came out.
Yep.
It's good.
Yep.
I think this will be the first book signing you'll do.
First book signing.
And tomorrow at Darvel's, and I've already read it, and it's great, and I think it really gets at the issues you're talking about. Now, here at Kindlingsfest, we brought three Sundance films, and it has been said that Hollywood films like to comfort the afflicted, and Sundance films like to afflict the comfortable. And I chose these films, and I have said this could get me fired, and it could, because these are edgy films, and these are not films that are going to just warm your heart, but they have an authenticity to them. When I was a kid, I used to hear the, whatsoever things are good, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are of good report, think on these things, therefore don't watch those stories, don't read literary fiction. And then I got to the part, whatsoever things are true. And I thought, wait a minute. And then I read, Jesus looked at the multitudes, and they were like harassed, like sheep without a shepherd. And he was moved with compassion. And I said, I need to rethink how to listen to culture, to hear My Neighbor's Hymnal. So that I can understand who they are. I can understand. You know, the amazing thing, if you understand the depth of the good news, is there is no story it cannot connect to. But the only story it can't connect to through you is the one that you are unprepared to try to hear and listen. And Jesus had no fear. He heard everybody's story. He never shared the gospel the same way twice. He didn't have a tract. He didn't have a formula. He had love. And he would listen to a person's story, a heartbreaking story about a woman who had five husbands. And he would hear her and see her. And he would enter into her story. And that's what these films are intended to help us do, is to get inside the story of other people. And tonight we're seeing an amazing one called Abraxas. It's the story of a young man who's a punk rock singer. He decides to become a Zen Buddhist monk, and 10 years later he has an emotional breakdown at a high school assembly when he's supposed to be talking about how much he loves being a Zen Buddhist monk, and he realizes, I miss music. I got to play music. So the next day he goes to the Zen master and says, I got to leave. And the Zen master helps him figure out how to resolve that. It was the tension Larry talked about earlier. Wait a minute, you mean I can be this and this? You say, well, this isn't a Christian film. Well, at the end of the film, at Sundance, you get to talk to the people that have made the films. And this guy is 29 years old. And I said, you know, I know something about the religious climate in Japan. And it's a culture that really respects religion. But I said, for a lot of the younger generation, it's not part of their life anymore. And I said, what prompted you to make this movie? And he said, well, there was a novel that I based this film on that was hugely popular in Japan that told this story. And he says, and then he says, I'm not a religious person, but he said, I've gotten to the place where I don't feel like I can live life without art, and I don't feel I can live life without a spiritual life. And it was this open seeker. So this film helps you. Chaim Potok wrote amazing books about young people raised in a Hasidic Jewish background who couldn't reconcile their faith, religious tradition, with their sense of gifts and calling. One of them was an artist, Asher Lev, and you go on and on and on. That's what this film does from a Japanese standpoint. So, Jeff, what is the value of film to you? Why should we be watching film? Mm. Why shouldn't I be fired?
Well, I will say to your elders, don't fire them for this reason, but I have other reasons later, I can tell you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff.
There have been a number of media critics who, when they talk about the rise of cinema, and particularly if you look at kind of the golden age of cinema out of the late 40s and moving into kind of the height of the Hollywood, you know, golden era, is the mid-70s, movies like Serpico and others coming out that time, that what cinema is for Western culture are the moving stained glass windows of our generation. They are statements made before you in images that are clear and compelling that move you to look out and through them, if you're looking at them correctly. One media critic, Jacques Lacan, talks about the power of a director to control your gaze, le regard in the French, the ability to hold you and make you look at something long and intentionally in ways that you would otherwise avoid. That's the power of a director, and that's the power of what cinema can do. But this is not a new thing. This is what the prophets did, as Michael Carr talked about earlier. You know, the prophetic utterance was, you know, to Amos, you know, what do you see before you? I see a bowl of rotting fruit. You know, what does that mean? Well, if you look at it long enough, with God's help, this becomes something so much more than just a bowl of rotting summer fruit. It becomes something else. Similarly with the documentaries that we watch, we can see it and maybe be offended by a profane act or something that disturbs us in our own sense of our sexuality, our own sense of morality. But if we look at it with the assistance of God and in the company of friends, right, if we watch it along each other as a discerning community, we may see through it as through stained glass windows and see the light that is coming through it on the other side. And so these documentaries are by filmmakers who are seekers. They're trying to make meaning, and they're using images put together with narrativity, stories, and want you to join together and see how you can put this together. One of the things that we're going to be doing is, late at 10:30 tonight, we're going to watch the films, but tomorrow we'll gather anybody who wants to come, even if you haven't seen it, you know, to sit around and we're having lunch together and just talk together. This is old school bread and fishes time. Sit down and talk about, what did you see? What did the Lord show you in this moment? How have you been impacted by this? And so we're going to practice good viewing together in that regard.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. We are going to call this portion of the Kindlings Muse at Kindlings Fest to a conclusion. Thank you, everybody, for being with us. And we'll be right back for the rest of the live audience right after this.